chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them.
But we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Well, folks, we've covered a lot of movies in which love happens surrounded by food, but I think it's time for us to talk about a movie in which the love interest is food.
Hot damn. Yes.
It is time for us to fall in love with food. So we're attempting that this week.
Eliza, I really love this because when we picked this movie, we were really discussing it. One of the things I said was like, I don't know if this is a rom-com. But then when I watched it again, you're absolutely right. It is a rom-com. And the unattainable love interest is the Cubano sandwich, which, you know, I agree.
I spent the whole movie just really wanting a Cubano sandwich. So it does work on that level. It makes you want the love interest.
Yeah, it's just, it's a very interesting twist on the rom-com genre where our main protagonist is a man, and not coincidentally, his love is food and success in his career. Well, here we go. Thanks, culture industry. You've really done us a good one.
I mean, you know, the normal heteronormative love story is also there because we can't get too far away from our basic structure. That would be ridiculous. So we're just gonna, you know, just shove a straight love story in there, even though it doesn't really matter to the story at all. But what we're talking about today, folks, for those who don't know, is the movie Chef from 2014. Yes.
Yes, that's right. Chef 2014, writer, director, Jon Favreau. You know, of Mandalorian fame, the guy who wrote the Iron Man movies.
Happy Hogan, that guy. I mean, I will say this man is a bit of a god to me. Like, as a giant geek, I'm like, this man is incredible and he has achieved all that all of us geeks want to achieve in life. So I do just naturally want to love everything he does.
And I hear that. Like, I think that's one of the things that we should talk about in this episode is how interesting it is that this is sort of like his big vanity project.
Yeah. Janelle, why don't you read us a little Google summary and then we'll talk about this vanity project.
Let's do it. All right. We're talking about Chef 2014. Here's your Google summary. After a controlling owner, played by Dustin Hoffman, pushes him too far, Chef Carl Casper, played by Jon Favreau, quits his position at a prestigious Los Angeles restaurant. As he tries to figure out what his next step should be, he finds himself in Miami. Carl joins forces with his ex-wife, played by Sofia Vergara, his best friend, played by John Leguizamo, and his son, played by MJ Anthony, to launch a food truck business, and the venture provides a chance to reignite his passion for cooking, as well as his zest for life and love. Well, Eliza, that's what Google says Chef is about, but what is it really about?
Well, a lot of people on the internet are happy to tell you that what this movie is really about is about Jon Favreau fighting against the greater powers that be at large film corporations like Disney. And I think that's probably part of it as well. But mostly, I think this movie is about Jon Favreau just living his best life and imagining a world in which he gets to be married to Sofia Vergara and also be butt buddies with Scarlett Johansson and have all of the funniest friends and all of the coolest jobs.
Yes. And therein lies one of my major critiques of this movie. And like, this is all to say, of course, that I understand that this is a vanity project. Like, you have no illusions from the beginning of this movie that it is anything but a vanity project. But there's so much complexity around the fact that he decided to make that move, right? To have this movie where all the women are in love with him, the beautiful, gorgeous women are in love with him, and all of his friends are super cool, about a character who's a chef. Because the culture of being a chef and cooking is such a toxically masculine culture that it really strikes me as interesting that he would want to sort of go head in with this. It just feels like such an aggressive assertion of masculinity and a very particular kind of masculine creative dominance that rubs me the wrong way. There are many charming things about this movie. I don't want to say there aren't, but from the outset, that rubs me the wrong way.
Interesting. You know, I think I wasn't as struck by the the masculinity of the position and the sort of masculine dominance of food culture as much. But what struck me was that it seemed an obvious leap for someone in Jon Favreau's position to make, to be like, how could I, you know, how would I want to portray myself? Oh, well, I'll be like a celebrity chef, because having worked on food shows and so been sort of involved in the food industry from that perspective, I think there's so much overlap between like film and TV celebrity and food celebrity that people who maybe don't see the inner workings of either of those realize. There's, you know, the, as you say, there's such a particular culture around chefs and particularly celebrity chefs, but any sort of high powered chef at a high powered restaurant, that of course someone who works in Hollywood would be like, oh, this is a cool career that gets you like fame and adoration and love and whatever, because Hollywood does treat fancy restaurants and clubs and restaurant owners and chefs in that same sort of hero idol worship way.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison. And I think that's why, like you said, the popular interpretation of this movie is that it's sort of a middle finger to the studio system, is that it's saying, you know, like, ah, this is kind of a one-for-one comparison. Mm-hmm. Hotshot writer-director, hotshot chef.
Yeah, they're definitely, the internet, as I was looking up this movie, was like, oh yeah, he made this because he was so tired of having to do exactly what Marvel and Disney told him to do for all of the Iron Man movies. And, you know, and he wanted to go off and do his like cool indie project, just like his character hates having to do what this restaurant owner makes him do and then goes off and has his food truck. But there's also been a few interviews with Jon Favreau where he sort of shied away from that comparison. So while I feel comfortable saying that his experiences as a, you know, big screen director obviously influenced this movie, I personally don't want to go ahead and make the claim like that it was directly supposed to be a commentary on his experience working with Marvel. Because I'm not sure that like we can really prove that. But certainly those overtones are all there, right? That kind of like, I'm the actual creative genius here, I'm the smarts, I'm the talent, but then there's some, you know, bigger overhead position who has to like make the decisions and who makes bad decisions and makes me have to do what he wants. Like, I think that's all there. But interestingly, I actually don't think the movie digs into that enough, because when everything blows up in his face at the restaurant, he gets mad at the critic, not at the asshole restaurant owner, who's the one who, in my opinion, fucked up.
Absolutely.
I kept expecting there to be this like big blow up with, you know, with him and the Dustin Hoffman character, and there wasn't. And I was like, but he's clearly the one who was in the wrong here. Like, everyone agreed that you should change the menu, and then the critic complained that you didn't change the menu, and then you yell at the critic for saying what you've already made it clear you agree with.
I know, exactly. Well, and that to me is where, that's one of the moments in the film where I feel like it gets the closest to actually making a statement about the toxic masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels like such a classic redirect of aggression, right? It's something that happens in heterosexual partnerships all the time, where you know, the woman will sort of be this punching bag for aggression that is actually directed at sort of like larger systematic issues.
Mm.
So it's almost like staging that in a way.
Yeah, I can see that.
But the movie never addresses it. Like you said, instead he sort of just like backs away from blowing up at this critic. We never see the Dustin Hoffman character again.
Mm-mm.
And ultimately, the people who set him up to succeed after that miserable failure are the women in his life, mm-hmm. Scarlett Johansson and Sofia Vergara, who both sort of pull the strings to make sure he's in the right place at the right time to make the next best move for himself.
Yeah, I feel like we need to talk about the Sofia Vergara character for a minute, because I was... the movie is not complex. It's not surprising. Like, exactly what you expect to happen is what happens, you know? And so I wouldn't argue that any of the characters are particularly deep, but her character in particular just felt like such a prop in a way that I found very disappointing coming from a mind like Jon Favreau's, right? Like, she just, like, she's his ex-wife, but she's supportive of everything he does. She's willing to drop everything at a moment's notice to talk him through how to deal with their son. She sets him up with his new business. By the end, she's also working weekends at his new business, and then they get remarried. And I was like, does she have any, like, we never even learned what her job is. She's clearly got some big, important Hollywood-type job because she's got a publicist, but they never even give us a clue about what career that might be. It's not important.
Never once. It's so wild. And she's got this huge house and all of these assistants. And at various times, Jon Favreau's character Carl makes these really misogynistic jokes about how she's using the divorce money, which I have to be like, I don't, okay. but yeah, we never get a sense of what it is that she's working on in Miami or in LA that, you know, allows her to fly first class and have all of these assistants. But also there's like holes in her motivation as an individual human being, mm-hmm. right? Like one of the more perplexing ones, in my opinion, is that they take their son to Miami to see her father, who's a musician, play in a club. And he's playing like this beautiful like Roomba music. And their son, as they're going there, is like, oh, this is where you grew up? Oh, this is where Abuelito lives? Oh, this is what Abuelito does? What's his job? What does he do? I'm like, this child is 10 years old. And you have you have money to fly first class. Has your child never met his grandfather? If so, why? Like, what happened?
Right, yeah. The kid ends up with a bit of expository questioning in that scene that did strike me as very odd. I was like, you know, I could believe that this is the first time they've taken him out to the nightclub where his grandfather performs. You know, they have this kind of thing where the dad's sort of like, oh, are we taking him out? Like, it's going to get, like, late and it gets kind of rough there. And she's like, yeah, I think he's old enough. Like, that I buy. But the idea that he doesn't know his grandfather is a musician who performs in nightclubs when he's 12 or whatever is like, what have you guys been talking about up until now?
Yeah, it's so bizarre. And, like...
Well, and I mean, this movie is... I think I enjoyed the movie a lot more than you did. And I did find it genuinely charming. And it's got these moments that are fun and lighthearted and again, just very charming, but they are sort of strung together with this kind of ill-conceived, you know, random bits of expository plot that just sort of plop in at random places. You know, even like the Scarlett Johansson character, who's the other main female character at the beginning, she's clearly, you know, one of the managers of the restaurant, but also seems to be the sommelier. You know, she's hostessing and seating people. Like, she sort of seems to be running everything. She's running interference between Jon Favreau and Dustin Hoffman. So you're like, okay, great. She's like, you know, she's actually the one who keeps this restaurant running. This seems, you know, a little crazy, but probably realistic. There's, you know, always that kind of person at a job. She also has this friendship with Jon Favreau, and then it's sort of implied that they're maybe sleeping together, but not really dating. And then she just continually tells him how great he is, and then she disappears out of the picture. And I'm like, look, I have no problem with her completely running the restaurant in a way that seems like she has 18 jobs. I have no problem with her having this, like, you know, social friendship as well as professional relationship with this character. But why? Where did it start? Were they working together before they ended up at this restaurant? Have they just been running this restaurant for so long that they're relying on each other because they're the only two people who get it? Does she have her own goals and opinions? What about working with Jon Favreau is a pain in the ass for her? Because chefs are a pain in the ass. They are. And none of his coworkers, other than the Dustin Hoffman boss character, are ever like, man, you are such a pain in the ass. I hate when you do this. Like, one moment of them being like, oh, he's changing the menu again. He always does this at the last minute. And there's never any of that. And so all of these characters around him are just these, like, sycophants.
Exactly. It's so frustrating. It's very much like the male version of a Mary Sue, which is a Gary Stew, right? Like, he is that character.
Oh, for sure.
Every single person in his orbit sees everything that he does as brilliant and fun and charming. And when there's one person who doesn't, he screams at them in a restaurant, you know? So, and then we're supposed to see it as sort of justifiable because this guy was being a jerk to him. And like, how dare he? This man's a genius. And he didn't want to put the menu forward. That wasn't his fault. It's not Jon Favreau's best effort in terms of writing, I would say. I would say, like, for example, there's a scene where Dustin Hoffman comes in. I think it's his first appearance. And he and Jon Favreau have this back and forth that is, I mean, I've seen a lot of really bad expository dialogue, but this was really high up there, where Dustin Hoffman says something along the lines of, you do know who's coming tonight. And Jon Favreau says, yes, I'm aware of who's coming tonight. And then Dustin Hoffman says, and you do know that he just sold his blog for $10 million to AOL. Jon Favreau says, yes, I know. Which is like, as a writer, when you're writing a character saying, yes, I know, twice in a row, like, you literally could not telegraph enough for us that this is just exposition for the audience, and it makes me crazy. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that, like, part of why I think this film is so charming, though, anyway, despite all of these problems, is that the cast is unreal. You have Dustin Hoffman and Jon Favreau doing these lines, so it doesn't seem like, you know, stodgy porn dialogue, but that's essentially what it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, Jon Favreau definitely just called all of his friends and was like, what are you up to next month? Let's make a movie. And they all went, yeah, that sounds great. Which, you know,
yeah, we're gonna film in Miami, we're gonna film in New Orleans, we're gonna film in Austin. Everybody was like, absolutely, yes.
Like, if you're that rich and that successful and you have that group of connections, like, why wouldn't you do that, right? Why wouldn't you call your network and just be like, hey, entire Marvel fam, let's go do an indie flick because we feel like it this week. I'll feed you. Like, yeah, that sounds great. And so you do, they all seem to be having a genuinely good time.
Yes.
And I mean, I think what this movie is really about from Jon Favreau's perspective is it's not really about the plot, it's about the filmmaking itself, right? Like, the cinematography of the food is phenomenal. The chance to, you know, have all these scenes in these different fun places like New Orleans and Miami is clearly, like, that's what it's about. And so there's just this, like, loose script that kind of ties it all together so that he can do these scenes that he really wants to do.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, as a major foodie myself who grew up on the I-10 corridor, like, a lot of the places that they go to eat are, like, legendary. Versailles, mm-hmm. in Miami, they went to Cafe Du Monde in New Orleans, they went to Franklin's Barbecue in Austin, which, let me tell you, the part where they skip the line to walk into Franklin's, go in the back and get four slabs of brisket, I was like, you can't do that, you have to wait 2 hours in line to do that. So yes, it's all very sort of like food fantasy in a lot of ways. And those sort of, like, set pieces, the set piece moments where they're in different cities and, like, engaging with the food culture are just, yeah, they're delightful, they're fun, they're sumptuous.
Well, and those bits that you're talking about where they can skip the line, blah, 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 that, again, is all part of that sort of Hollywood celebrity perspective, right? This kind of like, oh yeah, of course, these characters just have a connection to every famous chef. And these characters just, like, you know, are related to the head musician at this really popular club in Miami. And these characters just, you know, can drop everything to buy a food truck and just, like, randomly drive it around the country. You know, there's a real freedom that comes with wealth and connection that the movie doesn't even feel the need to explain. It's just sort of assumed about these characters. And you wouldn't be able to tell the same story otherwise.
I think one of the weirder choices in the movie that I would find strange in any film, no matter who's telling it, is that Carl as a chef, he is portrayed as finding, like, the aesthetic height or, like, the culinary height of his food in Cuban cuisine, which is really odd when you sort of juxtapose it. I mean, he's lived in Miami. His wife presumably is Cuban. She never states that, but it's all kind of assumed. She grew up in Atlanta, etc. He's getting all of this from a different culture's food, right? One that he's sort of tangentially related to. They show that he doesn't speak Spanish at all, which, for first of all, for a chef working in American kitchens is frankly shocking. because, like, 60-70% of your kitchen staff is going to be Spanish speaking. So I think that the cultural politics of him finding, you know, himself through another culture's food as a white male chef is a little troubling, but it's also very reflective of how celebrity chefs work, to be fair and to be honest.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that definitely, I found that very striking as I was watching the movie, because I was like, Jon Favreau is not Hispanic or Latinx of any type. I went back and checked on that. And he is not portrayed in this movie as being Latinx of any type either, right? Like, it's not like they're saying, oh, you know, because Jon Favreau is a little Italian, we're going to pretend he's Cuban. Like, no, he's playing a white man, but all of his friends are Latino. His wife is Cuban. His, you know, his kid is obviously part white, part Cuban. And he is in a restaurant where it does not seem to be a particularly, like, you know, particular ethnicity type restaurant. It's just sort of an American restaurant where he keeps trying to bring in sort of more exotic dishes and gets turned down, and they're like, no, make the basic stuff, make the beef, make the, you know, the flourless chocolate cake, whatever it is. But then he goes back to his roots where he got started in Miami, and he starts this Cubano truck, and I was definitely a little like, okay, but are all the people in Miami going to be flocking to this truck run by this white dude?
Right, like, they've never seen Cuban sandwiches in Miami before?
Like, right. And I mean, like, what? He's got John Leguizamo with him in the truck, so I guess that helps. But, like, you know, in a city other than Miami, I can see everyone being like, ooh, the El Jefe truck. Like, let's run over to it. But it's not like, like, he's fighting an uphill battle in Miami to be able to sell these.
I also, like, literally laughed out loud because, like, the first time I saw this, I was on a plane and it was really late and I was so perplexed by it that I had nothing to say. But on the second time, there's a moment where they're eating Cuban sandwiches together and Jon Favreau's character literally says, do you think people would like this kind of food back home in Los Angeles? And I, like, laugh snorted. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? One of the most diverse food cities in the world? They're not going to have had Cuban sandwiches before? What the fuck?
Well, and especially because I thought maybe he was trying to get to, like, would people eat this at, like, a fancy restaurant if I served this? Like, if I started another, like, five-star whatever. But no, he, like, starts a food truck business. And in the end, he gets a restaurant again, but it seems to be more of a sort of casual kind of food truck style eatery with a little more flavor and whatever, right? Like, so it's not like he's, like, going to a fine dining place and being like, and now we're making greasy street cart food, but, like, you know, advertising it as being high end, which would have been, to be fair, more annoying. But I thought that maybe that's where he was going, that he was gonna, like, bring, you know, Cuban street food to, like, the wealthy white mass public. But that's not really what happens. He just, like, starts a food truck. And, I mean, when he first tells his buddies that he's getting a food truck, they're all like, oh, man, he's starting a taco truck? Do we need another taco truck? Like, it's in there. It's in the script that, like, this is just another fucking taco truck. And so I don't know why it's presented as if it's, like, a big revelatory thing when anyone who lives in any major city in America can find, excuse me, a taco truck on every corner.
Reminder to everyone out there listening, support your local taco truck. Seriously, like, don't wait around for some asshole five-star chef to come and bring a taco truck to your town. There are really good taco trucks just hanging out everywhere you go. But yeah, I mean, it does. It just feels like so, it feels like so oblivious to what it is saying about food and food culture in America and who's, and what food counts as, like, high cuisine and what food counts as viable, what foods are more associated with, like, authenticity. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, somehow he makes it seem like by going back to these Cuban recipes, he's being more authentic. He's selling street food. It's, there's so much in that that the movie does not have space to unpack.
Yeah, well, and in order to make the movie, he did a bunch of actual chef's training with celebrity mm-hmm. chef Roy Choi. So there's also, like, he went to another, you know, high-end chef who's known for sort of high-end famous food trucks and things like that and was like, all right, teach me how to do this as authentically as possible. But again, not a Hispanic or a Latino chef. So there's an authenticity to the professional chef level, but maybe not an authenticity to the cultural and ethnic politics of the movie.
And I appreciate that that he went out of his way to be really authentic as a chef because, and I should say, I've dated two professional chefs, so maybe my perspective on this movie is a little bit jaded. But I did see, like, you can tell that the way that he uses his knife and the way he folds the towels and the way that he talks in the kitchen, it's very, very true. It's very true to how chefs are trained. Like, mm-hmm. the whole speech that he gives about how the chef's knife that he's giving to his son, which is actually a moment that I thought was really sweet. He said, you know, this is your chef's knife. The chef's knife belongs to the chef and not to the kitchen, so you have to take care of it. It'll last you a long time. Like, all of that is so true to, like, chef culture. But, of course, I'm sitting there thinking, like, oh, but you're, like, bonding with your son for the first time ever, and the only way that you know how to bond with him through your career and your mm-hmm. passions, which can become your kids, but it means that you're asking your child to come to you, to, like, live in your world in order to be, like, loved and seen. And so there's also a lot there that I find difficult.
Yeah, the whole kid storyline, like, again, it went exactly where I thought it was going to, but there were a number of times where I thought he was going to sort of learn to meet the son halfway, and instead he just keeps forcing the son to be involved in his world. which I found to be odd. I mean, the kid is, he keeps expressing that he wants to know more about his dad's life because he wants to be involved in his dad's life. So he's like, take me to the restaurant, take me to the whatever. But, you know, at one point he's teaching him essentially how to be a line cook in the taco truck, in the food truck. And, you know, the kid isn't taking it as seriously. And he's like, look, this is important to me. So if you want to be a part of it, it has to be important to you. And I was like, what a shitty thing to say to your 12-year-old. Like, yeah, you can tell him, like, we have really precise, you know, standards in this truck. And I want to make sure we meet them. But you can also say, like, but you're 12. And if you want to hop off the truck, you can. You know, like.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, that's a place where, like, the toxic masculinity, mm-hmm. what it's like to train in a kitchen. Because, you know, I mean, not recently, but in years past, apprentice chefs would start as teenagers and they would get treated like that, you know, like pretty brutally. The expectations are high. You have to move quick. You have to be precise and exact. And there isn't a lot of wiggle room. There isn't a lot of support. There is not sympathy for hurt feelings in a kitchen. And that, and therefore, it's not really a great place to have a kid. I saw that as the movie went on, like you said, it kind of moves predictably where he does soften a little bit towards his son. But you're constantly reminded of earlier moments in the movie where he would say things like, "What, you want me to come to Miami to be the babysitter of the kid? Oh, I'm sorry. Did you mean father your child? Mm-hmm. Did you mean take care of your child?"
I will say the one thing I liked about that is that she then treats him like the nanny, right? Like he says something about like, oh, instead of bringing the nanny, you're just bringing me. And so then she keeps being like, oh, yeah, you've got to deal with him on the plane. And oh, yeah, you're going to watch him tonight. And oh, yeah, can you go make sure that the rooms are ready? Like, you know, there's definitely, that's the one moment where I feel like he gives Sofia Vergara's character a little bit of bite. Where she's like, look, if you're going to act like an asshole, then, like, I'm going to treat you like an asshole. But then they all go to the club that night and everything is forgotten and forgiven. So there's no long-term or even short-term consequences for sort of any of the shit he pulls.
And speaking of that, Eliza, what did you think of the ending of the movie?
I mean, I knew it was going there. I didn't necessarily mind that it went there. I wish there'd been a little more heft to that resolution. You know, there's a couple moments where he and the ex-wife have, like, a moment. And you can tell that she's, you know, happy to see him getting back into what he loves and being better with their kid. And then they're like, and they're happily married again! And I was like, give me one scene of the two of them, like, having a romantic moment, or of him genuinely thanking her for her support and her genuinely saying how moved she is to see the ways that he's worked to improve himself and his relationship with their son. But like, it's all under the surface. It's all just implied. And so at the end, when they're like, and here's our happy ending, I just was like, okay, you didn't earn that.
No,
both as a script and as a man. As a man, he did not earn ex-wife Sofia Vergara back.
Yeah, like, it almost strikes me as symbolic the way that it happens, because if you haven't seen the film, the way that they show it is that it's big reveal. Carl gets to have the restaurant of his dreams based on the taco truck. He's backed by the critic who earlier, you know, critiqued it, but has now turned a new leaf and seen that he's really a genius after all. Okay. the camera pans through the restaurant. We see the food. It's all gorgeously shot. It's beautiful production design. Whoever did the food for this movie is a genius. It looks incredible.
Mm-hmm.
We pan over the food, and then we come down to a shot of Carl and Inez, his ex-wife, or Sofia Vergara, dancing in their wedding clothes. So there's almost this like symbolic feeling that like him opening this restaurant and him like, you know, coming back around to Cuban food is like us is like being manifested symbolically through his marriage to Inez again, which is mm-hmm. like, ooh, not great. It's weird, because, and that's because, like you said, we don't actually get the like substance of the relationship, so it all feels very like image driven, all symbolism driven rather than plot.
Yeah, there's definitely there's a heavy equating of it's like he's going through a midlife crisis, and when he gets through it and rediscovers his career passion and rediscovers how to be a good father and rediscovers how to be a good husband, like, then all is forgiven because he just, you know, went through this period where he was, you know, whatever, overtaken by the pressures of his career. And it's okay to just fuck off and screw over your marriage and your relationship with your child because your career has a lot of pressure. Because I'm sure that your wife has never felt that at all in her life.
In whatever job she has, which we'll never know.
Mysterious needing of multiple assistants in her house and also a, you know, PR person on call 24/7. Yeah, no, it's so forgiving to the men in a way that we never are forgiving to the women.
He never has a crisis at any point where he wonders, like, am I always going to be alone because I've prioritized my career? Am I a bad father because that I'm so invested in my career? No, he doesn't have to worry about that.
No, he doesn't. All work out. He doesn't have to worry about that because the women in his life do that worrying for him. Scarlett Johansson's character, who exists as his coworker and, like, possibly a recurring booty call, has a scene where she's like, now that you don't have this job anymore, you need to get your shit together and go back and focus on being a good father. We don't even know if she's ever met this kid, right? We have no information about her relationship to Jon Favreau outside of work or to his family or whatever. And yet she still is the one who's like, you know, I really think that you need to work on being a better father to your kid because you've been so focused on work. Like, she has to do that emotional labor for him. And she's not even his girlfriend.
Seriously, it's such a funny phenomenon, isn't it? Where you see this in movies and you know, because Joss Whedon pulls this shit too. Where it's like, I'm going to portray women as emotionally intelligent, put together, as, you know, self-assured go-getters. But then, like, sure, that's all great. You get a cookie, I guess. But then, as you say, then it just allows them to do all of the work, which is not equality. That's not equity, guys. Right,
being like, all of the women are so great that the men can be total shit is, like, not what feminists are asking for. Like, that was not the end goal, people.
No, stop that. Stop it right now. Like, there are literally sociological studies that show that even today, where men and women in heterosexual partnerships more or less make the same amount of money, in many cases women make more, but the share of domestic labor tasks is the same as it has been for decades, i.e. women do the vast majority of it.
Yes, the vast majority. All of these studies that show that women still do the vast majority of the physical work, right? Like laundry, groceries, cooking, all of that. And then even in households where that is more equal, not equal, but more equal, the women still do almost all of the mental, emotional, and planning work, right? Like, there are all these studies that show in a house where the man and woman will say, like, yes, we both do laundry, we both cook, we both blah, blah, blah. The woman will still be like, I put together the, you know, grocery list and the menu for each week. I keep track of when our kids need to have their doctor's appointments. I know where everything is in the house is, and my husband's constantly asking me where stuff is, right? Like, even men who think that they're doing their part are still, like, having to be asked to do the dishes, having to be asked to go pick up the kids because it's almost five, right? Like, this is not actually equal labor, because emotional labor is an actual commodifiable skill set, right? Like, jobs pay money for people to do this, to do the management aspect of it. And all of these women are just being trained to be managers, and the men are just doing the jobs asked of them.
And this exact mentality actually takes us to part of why I think and why other people have proposed chef work is so toxically masculine. Because you're looking at a career of basically domestic skill sets, right? Cooking, grocery management, those are all domestic skill sets. But when a man does them, they have to sort of be marketed in a weird way as, like, cooking, but for men. And so it develops this, like, really intense gatekeeping around, like, demonstrating your hyper-masculinity to contrast the fact that your skill set is extremely domestic. And if you were working in a household and doing that labor, you would be considered the quote-unquote wife in the household, right? So chefs like Carl in the movie tend to have lots of tattoos to demonstrate their masculinity. They tend to sort of, like, be sort of, like, bulky and muscular to demonstrate their masculinity. They tend to express themselves in aggressive and brusque ways to express their masculinity. So I think that mentality about labor is so critical to understanding both this movie and then the larger phenomenons in food culture.
That's such a great analysis. I really agree with what you're saying there about that sort of having to overcompensate for a job which is so largely composed of these otherwise considered feminine qualities. And it's not just the tasks of cooking, but also, especially in like a high-end restaurant, you've also got the presentation aspect of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like so much is about the plating, is about how the restaurant is laid out, is about the seating, is about the table settings, right? And all of that comes from what we in our culture consider to be feminine roles. So someone who has to be in charge of all of that, I can totally see why they would then take on a very masculine, like, I am in charge sort of vibe in order to make it seem like they're not like worrying about table settings all day, you know, because those things have become so gendered in our minds.
Wow, that's such a good point. I hadn't considered the front of house and presentation aspects of it, but you're so right. It really is like professional housewifery, real traditional hostessing.
My brain goes there because, again, having worked on food shows, so much of the prep behind the scenes is the plating. Like, you have entire production teams who are just there to plate the food nicely. Like, you've got a production team that's cooking behind set, and then you've got a whole team that's just putting things nicely on all of the plates and in the bowls and in the pots and pans and then bringing it out to set. And then you've got the celebrity chef being like, boom, I did all this, and they did none of it. So I've really, like, I've seen that in action, how much work goes into those little, like, no, if you just move the rib bone a little bit this way, and then it needs one sprig of, you know, whatever on top, and actually let's put it on the blue plate because it's going to look better on the blue plate than on the green plate. There's a lot of that kind of decorative elements that go into it, especially when you've got a big looking audience like this character does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things I love about culinary arts, right? Mm-hmm. It is art. It's just so beautiful, especially on the high end, where it's honestly sometimes more sculpture than it is actually about food.
Right.
Yeah. And it is. It's so funny how it is like such a traditionally feminine art, but it has to be given these like masculine qualities to feel mm-hmm. professionalized, to feel worthy of having this big team.
So I gotta say, I enjoyed the movie, but I think you've turned me around on it. I'm so much angrier at it now than I was an hour ago.
See, and you've done this to me a few times, so I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad that I've turned you on.
Well, all right. A swing and a miss there, John.
Sorry, John.
Go back to the Mandalorian.
Every week on the show, we like to take a moment to thank all of our Patreon and keep the show going, and especially our romantic leads, who are Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey. Y'all are delicious. Thanks.
For those of you who don't know, we've now been doing this for a year. So
oh my God.
Thank you to everyone who's been supporting us in any capacity over the last year. We made it, guys. We're in year two.
Somehow time keeps rolling on, and we're still in the pandemic, and we're still making this podcast.
We are still making it. We're not going anywhere. So if you want to help us continue to make it, you can support us on patreon.com/romcomkilljoys or go to our merchandise shop at romcomkilljoys.threadless.com. We've got some new stuff up there. Go check it out. And of course, like us on Facebook and Instagram.
So, Eliza, as you said, I think our friend Jon Favreau, our brother in geekery, did hit a miss with this one. So what are your antidotes for Chef?
All right. Well, I've been really thinking a lot about what I want to do as antidotes for all of these ones this month, because, you know, with food, it just opens up the possibilities so much more, I feel like. So I've got a few antidotes this week. My first one is, in fact, a cookbook. I suggest that you buy and use Sweet Home Cafe Cookbook, which is a cookbook that came out of the Sweet Home Cafe, which is the restaurant in the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. It was made as a collaboration with the head chefs from that restaurant. And it is a cookbook entirely about African American cuisine. And so it gets into a lot of the different cultures which have influenced African American cuisine. There are, you know, Caribbean-inspired dishes and Latinx-inspired dishes and straight-up African-inspired dishes and more sort of American, like on American soil-based dishes. And it talks a little bit about the history of those and where they come from and the very complex quilt that is African-American culture and African-American cuisine. And there's just some absolutely phenomenal dishes in there. For those who don't know, Sweet Home Cafe in the African American History Museum literally has like a 6-month waiting list to get into it. It's like the hottest ticket in DC. And the food is just absolutely phenomenal. So yeah, so if you are looking for something that has some, you know, more authentic and more maybe complex cultural culinary arts represented, that is a great cookbook to have on your shelf. The other thing was, one of the things I liked about the movie, of course, was them sort of traveling around and visiting different places and eating in the different places and experiencing that cuisine. And there are a couple of shows that I, in my pandemic, have been watching that include travel and food that I find to be just endlessly fun and silly and wonderful. And one of those is Travel Man with Richard Iowati. Richard Iowati is absolutely hilarious and so goddamn weird British comedian. And he goes around with various other celebs to different cities around the world, and they visit it for like 48 hours and just find sort of the weirdest fun things to do in all those cities. And it's quirky and strange and hilarious. You can find them like all on YouTube, basically. Go watch Travel Man. And then the other one, which is a more recent addition, is the show Men in Kilts, which is a show starring two of the stars from Outlander, where they just go around Scotland doing Scottish things. And of course, they eat Scottish food and they drink whiskey and they do Highland dancing and learn how to play bagpipes and all this kind of stuff. And it's just silly and fun. Men in Kilts with Sam and Graham. So that's what I would suggest you go entertain yourself with this week. Janelle, what have you got for us?
Well, as I stated, I am totally obsessed with the topic of toxic masculinity in cooking. So I would recommend two really great books that aren't explicitly about that topic, but really cover it quite well. The classic is the late Anthony Bourdain's book, Kitchen Confidential, which I recommend to anyone to read for any reason. But also, journalist Bill Buford has an amazing book called Heat, which is about him being an apprentice cook in Mario Batali's restaurant in New York. It's very revealing. It's very hard to read in some ways. It's very intense, but it's a really good picture of the kind of culture that produced a person like Carl in Chef. But ultimately, my big recommendation is my favorite piece of nonfiction writing, period, bar none, that I think actually in part inspired this movie. And it's the New York Times article As Not Seen on TV by Pete Wells, which is an infamous review of Guy Fieri's Times Square restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't read this viral piece of perfection, let me just tell you, I'm going to read you my favorite line, which honest to God is the most sublime thing I've ever read in a piece of nonfiction. Ahem. When you saw the burger described as Guy's Pat La Frida custom blend all natural Creekstone Farm black Angus beef patty LTOP lettuce tomato onion and pickle SMC super melty cheese and a slathering of donkey sauce on garlic buttered brioche, did your mind touch the void for a minute? I mean, it is magnificent. The review they came up with in the movie in Chef has nothing on this.
Nothing.
Absolutely savage. It is unbelievable. Please read it.
It's a classic.
I read it about once a year, just to affirm my desire for a living.
Just to remind you that there's toxic masculinity rampant in the culinary world, especially in Times Square.
Yes, yes. On every side. The critics, the chefs, the fans, everyone. It's all toxic. But I love it. I'm part of it too. I get it. I'm a fan. Oh boy. Well, that's that. That's that, Eliza. Do we have one more or two more weeks of food topics?
Yep, so that was our third week of food. Stick around to see what we'll be sinking our teeth into next week.
It probably won't be Cuban sandwiches, but damn, that does sound good.
I might go eat one right now. Yeah. Go eat a Cuban sandwich, everyone.
Seriously.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone. See you next time. Start some kissing and making